Mrs. Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins. When most of us turn on the light switch, we don't think of how that electricity was generated. But in America, 50% of it comes from burning coal, and the byproduct of that way of generating power is coal ash. Because of that, we produce 100 million metric tons of coal ash each year. All that coal ash has to go somewhere. Some of it's been drained off into storage ponds, and on occasion those ponds leak, as we recently witnessed on the Dan River. But coal ash has also been incorporated into building materials. Recently there was a suggestion to use it under a runway at the airport. Well, a suggestion like that was rejected, maybe for obvious reasons, because of recent news. Still, there are people working to find new ways to repurpose coal ash, and we're going to talk about that with a few of them this hour. John Daniels is Associate Professor and Interim Chair of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UNC Charlotte. Brett Tempest is Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering also at UNC Charlotte. Good morning and welcome to the two of you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. And Chris Harden is a professional geotechnical and environmental engineer who works in various areas around the country using coal ash for various reasons, which we'll talk about. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Coal comes from the earth. It's been there forever. It will be there forevermore. Why then is coal ash such a problem? Why is it a problem for being on the earth, in ponds, out of ponds? What's the problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so it is everywhere. It comes from the earth. And as such, if you think about the properties of coal ash, it is a lot like soil. It's basically silica, alumina, iron oxides, all the things that we have just in soil just outside the studio or outside your office or home. So, of course, there are a number of reasons why sometimes there's a concern. I suppose the chief issue now deals with leachability. There is this concern that perhaps there are other constituents associated with the ash, which in the presence of water could migrate into our water
supply. But weren't they there in the coal?
Sure. That's just where
not
it comes
as,
from.
Just not as concentrated.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. That's where this all comes from, the coal and the rock adjacent to it. I mean, when you mine coal, we don't have surgical precision, right? I mean, you've got to excavate the coal and some of the rock adjacent to it comes with it. And so the metals come along for the ride, both in the coal and the rock adjacent to it.
So talk to me about what coal ash actually is. Most of us have only seen photographs of it in the paper or people putting their hands in that water in the Dan River and coming up with this gray gunk on their hands.
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah, so it's a powdery gray substance. In fact, I realize this is radio, but I did bring a little sample in that you could perhaps show later to folks who can log on.
Is that it right there?
It is. And so it's a powdery gray substance, and it's what's interesting about it, mostly silica is the primary component, but if you were to zoom in with an electron microscope and magnify maybe 10,000 times, it's intriguing in the sense that it's a collection of spheres or balls that you see. And so these unique properties, the fact that it's a lot of silica and the fact that it has a high surface area, makes it really useful for construction applications.
It is very fine.
Yeah, flour, right?
Yeah. And this is contained in a sealed box, which makes me wonder. But it's a sealed box with the American Coal Ash Association logo on it. That indicates there's an American Coal Ash Association.
There is.
What do you get together? Have parties? What do you do?
Actually, we have meetings four times a year. I'm a member of the ACA.
And what do you talk about?
We talk about a lot of it is reuse of coal ash and also how to perfect it in cement, using it with cement and concrete. We talk about dealing with the regulations that are coming now, how to address those.
This is labeled coal fly ash, which is the official term for coal ash. Class F.
Right.
What does that mean?
You got different types of ash, and three main categories you might consider. One would be class F, which you were holding there, and that would be low lime content. Or you have class C, which would have higher lime. And the difference is with the class C ash, you go on and mix that with water, and it's pozzolanic, it's reactive, and it can also be used to stabilize and increase the strength of soils. Class F, you add it with water, it's not going to solidify. Class C would solidify. And then the other thing to consider is how much carbon you have on it, because if you want to use it, you generally want to have a low carbon content. Otherwise, it affects its use for concrete.
Can you control what kind of coal ash you're producing when you burn coal for electricity, or is it dependent on the actual coal that you're burning for electricity?
The latter. It depends on the coal that you're burning. It depends on the plant in which what you're burning it, the temperature, and it also ultimately depends on where you place that ash. Is it dry handled? Is it wet handled? That sort of thing.
We're going to talk about this, but and as we talk about some of the products that are being made or using coal ash, it seems to me that there might be money to be made in this for the electric companies that are burning the coal ash. Why have we been dumping it in ponds when we could use it and sell it and make things from it?
Well, I'll take a first crack at that and then quickly hand it off to my colleagues here. Certainly, if you can use it all, that's what you ought to do. And that would be, if it's one message I hope to get across, is of all the things that are discussed, reuse ought to be the emphasis and the focus. Now, Dan River aside, the issue is often economics. You know, there's only so much concrete that you need. There's only so much of these other products that we need to have. And so and then plus the quality's got to be a certain level. So if you're producing X number of tons of ash, but a fraction of that doesn't meet the specifications needed for concrete and or there just isn't a whole lot of need for that much concrete, well, you got to put it somewhere.
And people get very upset when they hear about spills like the Dan River and what happened in the Tennessee Valley. But you have to understand, and you pointed this out in one of the articles that I read from you, John, is that coal ash is going to be with us for a very – if we stop burning it this instant, it's going to be with us for a very long time because we have an enormous amount of coal ash on hand. How much do we have?
This is a great question. So if you think about it, as you said, we generate 100 million tons of this every year. If we stop burning coal today in the country, somewhere between 2, 3, 4 billion tons. In North Carolina alone, if you just look at the ash ponds, maybe 100 million tons. So it's there. And it's not going to, you know, magically disappear. Mm-hmm. So maybe we ought to take a closer look at how we can reuse and move it in a responsible way.
We're going to talk about some of the things that, Brett, you have been doing with coal ash at UNC Charlotte. And we had some of your colleagues on to talk about the environmental house. I've forgotten the name of the
Solar Decathlon.
The Solar Decathlon. We've had some people talk about that on several occasions. And it's a green house. And everybody loves green. But in that house is coal ash. We'll talk about how you've been using that. We'll talk about, Chris Harden, what you've been doing with it around the country, what other companies are doing with it. But people get very upset when they hear about these spills, and we become very alarmed because of the harm that this substance is allegedly doing to the environment. What is going to be the long-term environmental impact of the spill in the Dan River from coal ash?
So some of that question requires additional study and analysis. But looking at the data that we have so far suggests that the impact is very limited. And this is also, if you reflect on the other two accidents that we've had similarly, in the Delaware River in 2005, the TVA in December of 2008, in all of these situations, when you've got a river flowing nearby at a reasonable flow rate, the impact is unmeasurable just days and weeks after the event. So in the case of the Dan River, they analyzed for 40 different constituents, upstream and downstream, shortly after. A wonderful effort by lots of folks, but the North Carolina Department of the Environment and Natural Resources did a wonderful job collecting this data, putting it on a website so you could scroll through and see what was it upstream, what was it downstream. What happens if you filtered the water? What happens if you didn't filter the water? And looked at a sample of essentially water that was clouded with these ash particles, and what was the impact? So out of those 40 different constituents, the impact was relegated essentially to four constituents. And that would have been aluminum, iron, copper, and then arsenic. But to put this in perspective, and again, this is, you know, we don't want to dump ash into the river. And the fact is there are constituents in ash which are objectionable. So I think people are rightfully concerned about how we manage this stuff. But if you think quickly about the Dan River, 40 micrograms per liter was the maximum concentration of arsenic. Now, to put that number in perspective, that's less than if you took a liter of Dan River water and consumed that the day after the spill. That would be less arsenic than the Centers for Disease Control estimate that you consume naturally every day just because of exposure. Arsenic occurs naturally. It's in our air. It's in our water. It's in our food.
So knowing what the three of you know about coal ash and how it's used and how it's handled when you're actually manufacturing things from it, and the people who are exposed to it through that process, should we as consumers, should we as citizens be as upset as perhaps some people got when these spills occur? Is it the danger that we think it is, because we react to it like this is the worst thing that's ever happened, and maybe it is, but maybe it isn't.
Right. No, I would have to agree with the direction of that question in the sense that it's a construction material, and like any construction material, we got to handle it properly. As far as the relative risk, this is a non-hazardous material, and we can get into the basis for calling it non-hazardous and how can we say that when in fact you have constituents like arsenic and chromium and selenium in there. Happy to go into those details. But suffice it to say that on the grand scheme of things, this is a material that we can manage. This is a risk that we can contain. Now, we have to do it, and certainly having ash and unlined ponds in perpetuity is not the best way to manage that material.
Yeah. Right. I want to come back to that, but Chris, you look like you
want to chime in. The one thought is there's been a concerted effort to label coal ash as toxic. Now, there really has to be a clarification on that term, and a lot of that I get, frankly, from John Daniels and the folks at UNC Charlotte, but toxicity is something that has objective ways to define that and measure it. And John, if you could comment on that, that would help.
Well, sure. I mean, toxicity really depends on the concentration, the exposure. If you think about toxicity, it's the same thing as sort of a poison. And whether something is a poison or a remedy depends on the dose.
Well, I was kind of shocked, and I think many people were, when they read newspaper articles about this and heard reports on the radio and television about the coal ash spill in the Dan River, that the EPA does not categorize coal ash as a hazardous material. It's not hazardous waste.
Correct.
Why not? It's got arsenic in it. It's got selenium in it. It's got other nasty things, other heavy metals
right, that
are not good for us, or fish.
Yeah. Well, and so does natural soil. Well, so part of the history of that, though, goes – actually, if you think about this, so there's a piece of legislation that's central to all this, and that's the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And that was enacted in 1976, and that's the piece of legislation that defines how we manage garbage, municipal solid waste, and hazardous waste. How do we handle this? How do we bury it? How do we line it? How do we monitor to make sure we're not having an environmental impact? So that legislation 4 years later in 1980 was reauthorized. And at that time, there was a Democrat congressman by the name of Tom Bevel, and he put in an exemption for fly ash, coal combustion products in particular. Mm-hmm. And so and now, of course, the stipulation was that the EPA is going to have to revisit that determination. And they did. And so if you look at 1993 and then 2000, the EPA came back and reaffirmed that it's non-hazardous.
It used to be, and maybe in some places it still is, that people fire their furnaces in their homes in the winter with coal.
Yeah.
The byproduct of that would be coal ash,
yeah,
would it not?
Yeah, and indeed. And my house is 110 years old, and I still found a few lumps of coal in the basement. So I would relate to that.
So when people were regularly shoveling this coal ash out of the furnace because they had to make room for new coal, and
right, it's
like just like running your fireplace. You got to get the ash out.
You bet.
Were they in danger? What did they do with that coal ash when they took it out? They just put it in the backyard in a trash can and let it go away?
Right. No danger. The only danger that you could conceivably have in that scenario is breathing in the dust. I mean, as you observed, and if anyone looks at ash, it's fine particle.
Yeah, very fine.
So you don't want to inhale that for the same reason you don't want to inhale dust of any sort.
Is that why it's still – it's many cases, many times it's stored in a wet condition?
Yeah, well, in part, but also because that's been an easy way to convey it. So again, you burn coal and the light stuff goes out the stack. The heavy stuff settles at the bottom and you got to collect it. Now, at one point, we weren't collecting it. We just had these plumes of smoke going out the door. But if you do collect it, you got to get it somewhere where you can store it, and we can talk about that after the break.
Storing it and what to do with it and what, in fact, is being done with it, which is where we're going with this conversation. When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare, celebrating 10 years of offering concierge medical care, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. 704-554-8787. Well, last weekend, veteran broadcaster Carl Kasell was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for the last time. The former NPR newscaster is retiring. He went into partial retirement. Now he's really retiring after a 60-year career in radio. And to celebrate, we're going to listen back to our 2005 conversation with Carl Kasell. We talked about everything from barbecue and his love of magic tricks, to his North Carolina roots and his long career from the very beginnings of it. And that will be on tomorrow's broadcast here on Charlotte Talks. We start at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, inspectors have increased the number of VA medical centers under investigation for alleged substandard care and falsifying wait times. The crisis at Veterans Affairs and what can be done to fix the system.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about coal ash, and eventually this hour we will talk about repurposing it and putting it to something, some better use other than putting it in a storage, an online storage pond next to a river. John Daniels is with us, Associate Professor and Interim Chair of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UNC Charlotte. Brett Tempest, Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering there as well, and he's going to talk about some of the things that the university has been doing with this in terms of repurposing coal ash. Chris Harden does this professionally. He is a geotechnical and environmental engineer who works around the country. That little box of coal ash that we referred to on the air in the last segment, we've taken a photograph of it. In moments from now, it will appear on Twitter and on Facebook and probably eventually on our website so that you can see it. And coming up on June 3rd, representatives from Duke Energy will join us to talk about coal ash as well. Physicians for Social Responsibility wrote an article, and they, in that article, call coal ash toxic. You have just said, not a big deal.
Right.
Who's right? Who's wrong?
Yeah. Well, look, I would defer to your listeners on that, but I would simply suggest that to call something toxic, again, it depends on how much of it you're consuming. So, you know, you can hold ash in your hand. It's in and of itself, it's not toxic. I think the great controversy—
But does that mean it's safe?
Sure, and although it does depend on how you use it. And so here's where I suppose we need to get into the details here. Coal ash, if you go on and shake it up with water, can leach out certain constituents at levels that are greater than drinking water standards. So, for example, we regulate arsenic in our water quality for human health at 10 micrograms per liter. For aquatic health, that's 50 micrograms per liter. Just before the break, we had pointed out that in the Dan River, the peak concentration of arsenic found in the Dan River was 40 micrograms per liter. Now, I should point out that after that spill, some folks sort of expressed surprise, and I suspect the authors of that article you mentioned were also sort of surprised, and there was this sense that, well, we got lucky, or we just happened to came close to having a real problem there. But actually, if you look at how ash leaches and how much metal is there in the first place, whether it's arsenic or chromium, again, this is less than 1% by weight, and not even all of that which is there leaches out. But it does leach, and if you look at how much is there and then how much dilution occurs, whether it's in pore fluid in groundwater or in a river, you can actually reasonably predict what these downstream concentrations could be. So do you want to drink water that's been percolated through ash? No. I also don't recommend you do that with water that's been percolated through soil in your backyard. But at the end of the day, if you think about the standard of care in 2014 and moving forward, this stuff should be lined. This stuff should not be placed in the groundwater. And so when you're
and
using
so why ash, do we? Why do we have 33 unlined coal ash ponds in North Carolina? Whose idea was that?
That's just the way it was historically handled. It was done that way for years, as John said, to convey it to a pond. Okay, and the approach is changing right now. Okay, after Kinston, people said maybe we don't want coal ash in our rivers and our water, and there was a whole swing toward changing regulations, toward changing how we handle coal ash.
But we're going to talk about – well, we'll talk about it a little bit right now. One of the things that you do, Chris, is you go around the country and you help people use it to amend the soil, to build embankments. So the coal ash is put not in the container, but it's put directly on the soil. And that's what they were proposing at Charlotte Douglas Airport.
Right.
And why is that – any better than putting it in a coal ash pond that might leak into the river or leach into the surrounding soil? What's the difference?
The difference is how it's placed, okay? What happens with a structural fill, and I'll be honest, North Carolina has some of the strictest regulations on structural fills for coal ash in the country. You know, I look at regulations all over the country, and they have some of the strictest. You go ahead, first of all, you have guidelines and siting restrictions when you put it in a structural fill, okay? You have you keep it away from the groundwater. You keep it away from
drinking
water.
How can you do that?
Wells.
If you're putting, for instance, if they had used coal ash to build up embankments at the airport, which is, I think, I'm oversimplifying, but that's what they were going to do. It rains. The rain runs off.
Right.
It's going to carry particulate matter with it in microscopic form usually. But why wouldn't that rain be taking the bad stuff out of the coal ash that's mixed in with the soil and putting it into the drinking water or into the aquifer for that matter?
Well, and there's guidelines on that. You have one of the guidelines.
But how can you control it?
By lining it and covering it.
Lining it and covering it with soil. Okay. Also by making sure you're putting in a place where there is no nearby water source. But the requirements in North Carolina, but also with ASTM 2277, that's an official ASTM method, you're going to cover it after you place it. You're going to make sure there is no runoff.
Well, and so the cover, and when you think of covers, you can think of different options. One option is just soil. Again, remember, if you're using a foot of ash, you can put that anywhere. Doesn't matter. You take 75 feet of ash, then you might have to think about where you're placing it and how you're covering it. So at the Charlotte Airport, what was specifically proposed was having what's called a geomembrane. Think about a very thick, hefty bag. They sometimes refer to that as the burrito approach because they were going to encase that in a cover and a liner. And so, you know, the notion of having rain or anything else get through that liner, these are time-tested barrier materials. That's how we currently contain our garbage. Do so very well. It's also how we contain more difficult forms of waste, and we've got decades of success with that. So if we can control it for garbage, I think we can control it for ash at an airport.
But how long can we control? Because all these plastic products eventually, I would think, over thousands of years will break down.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, looking at modeling this impact over thousands of years, what's the influence? I think there, you know, perhaps the one way of looking at this, framing it with respect to all other risks, is anything guaranteed forever? I suppose not. But if you go back to the airport, what's the comparison? So if you're not using ash, what are you going to use? You're going to use the existing soils. And how do those existing soils compare to the ash that would be used instead? Is it superior in terms of strength, in terms of durability, in terms of other characteristics that would provide the airport with long-term performance? I think that's one of the issues to consider. And
there's a long-term history too, Mike. There's ash has been used underneath runways for, you know, for the last 15 years. It's also been used underneath highways for years. They have extensive reports on how to use it. You're placing it at a certain compaction requirement. Sometimes you're adding lime or cement. So it may not just be ash by itself. Mm. It may be encapsulated with another
material. Well, let's talk about how it's being used, because before we started this conversation on the air, one of you said, it's all around us already. What products, Brett, and I know you work with, you're trying to create new uses and safer uses and more special uses for this, but what products is coal ash in even as we speak?
The primary use for coal fly ashes is actually in concrete, and it's a process we've used. I think some of the first usage was actually in the Hoover Dam, not very frequently used in the earlier part of the century, but certainly in the last 30 years, it's been put into concrete as a partial substitute for Portland cement, which is the binding agent in concrete. And the benefits of putting it in, one is economy. And the second that we've discovered over the course of those 30 years that we've been using it fairly extensively is actually durability benefits, workability benefits, and then more recently, one that's been appreciated significantly more is reduction in the carbon emissions that are associated with producing concrete.
This is kind of surprising and rather perverse, actually, because what you're saying is that this substance that we are all afraid of and are all angry about being spilled into the Dan River, when you put it in concrete, it is actually – it becomes a green product because it takes more energy to produce the Portland cement than it does to produce the coal ash,
right,
which can then be used to strengthen concrete, correct?
Exactly.
Am I simplifying that correctly?
No, I think you got it exactly right. And the way that we analyze the life cycle of materials, because the fly ash itself is a waste material, it becomes somewhat dissociated from the carbon that was produced as it was produced. So the carbon becomes associated with the electricity. Mm. By recycling it, you know, we have a material that we can use to replace Portland cement in the concrete. The Portland cement itself, internationally, accounts for somewhere between 7% and 10% of our global greenhouse gas emissions. It's a hugely energy
because of the manufacturing of it.
Because of the manufacture of it, and a portion of that, and it actually works out stoichiometrically to be about a ton of carbon dioxide per ton of Portland cement manufactured.
Wow.
And a portion of that is related to the fuels that we use to heat cement kilns, which are primarily fossil fuels. And another portion of it is linked actually to the chemical process of making cement. So we drive carbon dioxide off of limestone in order to make the cementitious agents in Portland cement. So it's not really a process it's not really emissions that we can very easily escape, except by substituting something else for the Portland cement.
So it's in concrete, but it's also in floor tiles?
Yeah, floor tiles,
ceiling tiles,
roofing material. I mean, we very well may be surrounded by fly ash right here in the studio.
Really?
But in products, it's only going to take about half of the fly ash every year on average. That's not only in the U.S. Europe also recycles coal ash, okay? And about half of it goes into products. The other half needs to go into structural fills and roadway fills to be able to reuse.
So we really could not use – we could not reuse all of the coal ash that is produced annually, could we?
Not in building products because we're not building enough.
Although one might argue that there's an opportunity to change our posture and encourage its use. So if you think back to 2010, just shortly after the TVA spill – just up to that point, the Environmental Protection Agency had a partnership. This was a partnership between the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Federal Highway Administration, the American Coal Ash Association, in an effort to promote the use of coal ash. So if you think about that posture and the notion that let's actively look for opportunities to reuse this material responsibly, how then might we fare better in terms of reuse rates as opposed to the mode we're currently in, which is second guessing, we've got a concern, this is a problem, and now what you're doing is you're forcing that material to more landfills. So the less you use it, it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So you're going to put it in more landfills and clog up that space.
So I remember when UNC Charlotte was on to talk about the solar decathlon, that one of the things that you and your colleagues were doing, you were developing this geopolymer concrete. I take it that uses some portion of that geopolymer concrete uses coal ash, correct?
That's right.
What is geopolymer concrete? Remind us, because I don't remember.
Okay. Geopolymer is a binder, and it can be used to create concrete, which is functionally very, very similar to Portland cement concrete, mm-hmm. the same stuff that we see all around us. The difference in the two is that to make Portland cement concrete using fly ashes, we can replace maybe 30% of the cement with coal ash. With geopolymer cement concrete, we're able to replace 100% of the Portland cement, and the binder is entirely fly ash. And so it's a much higher volume replacement.
Was this a new technique that you folks developed at UNC Charlotte?
It is new, and we'd like to claim that we made the first geopolymer cement concrete mm-hmm. structure in the States.
How did you stumble upon the idea? I'm sure you didn't stumble upon it, but how did you decide to go in that direction is a better question, I suppose.
Oh, it was an interesting decision. The students that were designing the solar decathlon house elected to use concrete to make the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of evaluating the sustainability of a structure that was made out of concrete, for residential use, there are a lot of benefits that were associated with that in terms of thermal mass and durability and so forth. A lot of that is described in the design intent on the website for the house. But using such an energy and emissions intensive material to manufacture that really had some problems in terms of the overall life cycle analysis of the house. And so they wanted to keep the concrete. They didn't want to keep the emissions. And so they elected to use geopolymer cement concrete.
So since the decathlon, which was a couple of months ago, using that geopolymer concrete, what has happened to that as a product? Has industry taken a closer look at it? Have builders taken a closer look? Where does it stand now?
Having that example of the house made out of geopolymer cement concrete really, I think, was exciting, especially to precasters that might be able to take advantage of that material and expand product lines and so forth.
And these are people who make big slabs of prefabricated two-measure concrete that you get shipped on the back of a truck and then put it at the building site.
Huge stuff, right. This could be parking decks. It could be inhabitable structures. It could be pavements. It could be bridges. You know, it virtually our full range of concrete products could be precast as opposed to site-cast.
In your experience, Chris, around the country, builders, manufacturers, road builders, whoever, how many industries or how many product manufacturers are incorporating coal ash into the products that they make?
For concrete, it's tremendous numbers because we have standard guidelines. We have standard guidelines that actually show how you use the coal ash in the concrete.
And the guidelines are for what? To make sure that the concrete is strong enough?
Strong enough, and
there's a structural integrity to it or safety of it?
It's the structural integrity, and actually we now have test methods showing that it's not going to leach either. There's not going to be any problems with anything coming out of the concrete. Now, we've known that for years. Now we're just having to prove it and go ahead and do additional testing on it. The other side there, too, is there's a whole business aspect to this. Okay, Americans like things cheaper. Geopolymer concrete in its development stage may cost more. Mm-hmm. Just like recycled paper, you tend to pay a little bit extra for that. Mm-hmm. But it's also good for the environment. We have to look at that. There's a business development aspect that we have to encourage these markets by being able to support it and buy that type of material.
And do you do that through tax incentives, or how do you encourage it?
Well, I think a lot of it. Well, there's two ways. One thing we need to do right now is there's actually been a move in some of the attempts and environmental groups to actually score things lower if it has coal ash. Okay, because they don't understand the emissions have already come out of the coal. we've already had greenhouse gas emissions from that. Now it's just a byproduct. Okay, now we need to go ahead and recycle it. But there are, you know, in some of the scoring mechanisms, there has been a concerted move to go ahead and score products with coal ash lower.
Is that because they're afraid of that byproduct of the coal ash itself, or because they don't want to encourage more burning of coal to create more coal ash in the future?
Well, and that's a great point. If I could just quickly jump in, I would encourage folks to try to separate the two, because in fact, there is a large fraction of those who, all things coal, let's just get rid of it. We don't want this. This is a problem. And so for sure, that is a significant motivation to try to ban coal ash in the minds of some. However, again, even if you subscribe to that, we've got this material. So let's at least try to use it as much as we can, would be my suggestion, to try to redirect that.
We keep coming back to the fact that we still have 4 billion metric tons at least somewhere floating around the country, and that's just this country.
Right. It's not unlike the waste stream that's coming out, or the byproduct stream that's coming out. I call it byproducts because I think it can be used. It's not unlike what happened with MSW. We want to recycle. Municipal solid waste.
Okay.
We want to recycle as much as that is possible. We have clear incentives to do that with municipal solid waste. We wanted the same thing with coal ash. But there's actually some of the moves against coal ash have actually put a stigma on the coal ash and caused it to actually see a decrease in the beneficial reuse the last 3 years.
And because you built a greenhouse using a product that includes coal ash, will that help change people's minds over time? It's viewed as green. Very quickly, we have 20 seconds.
I hope it changes people's minds about viewing this as a resource that can be recycled. Mm-hmm. I don't think it necessarily needs to change people's minds about coal burning.
Brett Tempest is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at UNC Charlotte. He's here with John Daniels, also with the school, and Chris Harden. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. Inspectors have increased the number of VA medical centers under investigation for alleged substandard care and for falsifying wait times. The crisis of Veterans Affairs and what can be done to fix the system, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to put your two cents worth in about coal ash and the possibility of finding more uses for it other than sitting in collecting ponds, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us. If I could give you the right address, and we are coming right back.
Will Shortz, is there really such a thing as an enigmatology degree?
Well, there is for one person, and you're speaking to the world's only person who has one, and I devised an entire curriculum in puzzles.
I'm Rachel Martin, and even you can match wits with enigmatologist Will Shortz and catch up on the latest news on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tune in Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with John Daniels, an associate professor and the interim chair of the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at UNC Charlotte, with his colleague Brett Tempest, an assistant professor there who helped work on the solar decathlon and the development of the geopolymer concrete that is considered to be green despite its use of coal ash. And Chris Harden is here, a professional geotechnical and environmental engineer. Now, there are in coal ash arsenic, chromium, selenium, and other things that could leach into the soil, into the groundwater, etc. But when it's in a building product, when it becomes part of the concrete, what you're saying is, or when it becomes part of a floor tile or becomes part of a tile on the ceiling, it is not going to leach, even if it gets wet. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, and actually EPA has, they've actually published documents on that recently. They're using the word encapsulation.
Mm-hmm.
Encapsulated products are not going to leach any of these constituents out.
Well, now, this, although it's been used for 40 years, coal ash, maybe longer in concrete products, correct? And other products.
Correct.
It's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
I remember going to a school that was constructed in part with asbestos, which was then marketed as being a wonderful thing because the school was not going to burn down, okay? Then I worked at Channel 3. I shouldn't even say it. It's too late. The cat's out of the bag. And they were doing a remodeling project in the studios, and they had to encapsulate the remodeling area in sheets of plastic because they discovered when they built the building there was asbestos in the building. They had to remove the asbestos.
Right.
So asbestos maybe wasn't so good. And there are other things that we used in the past that were called wonderful things that maybe weren't so good after all. How do we know that we start tearing down these buildings and these highway bridges, et cetera, that have been constructed with concrete that's full of coal ash, that's not going to be a problem in the future.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And also to juxtapose with that, if you think about our waste management practices, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we were also dumping ash in unlined ponds. Thought that was a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
So part of it has to do with what's going on when you encapsulate it. So in the case of concrete, you're forming new minerals and you're taking the trace metals that were initially granular, loose on the surfaces of particles, and you're incorporating them into a new mineral structure. Now, look, the fact of the matter is you take anything, any product, you even take concrete, and if you grind it back down and go on and shake it up with an aggressive acid, you might, in fact, be able to pull some of that stuff back off of there. So, I mean, we do have to be a little circumspect in the sense that part of this is what's the realistic exposure to the stuff?
Well, let's compare it to lead paint.
Yeah.
Because if you try to sell a house that's 100 years old, you know that there's a layer of lead paint somewhere on the walls of that house.
Right.
And if you – I think you have to disclose that there's lead paint. And if you tear a wall out, you have to take all these precautions. Is it any worse than having lead paint? Is it less
So lead paint is more accessible. And I can relate to that personally. I can tell you when my daughter was not yet one, she found to chewing on the windowsill. And I had to develop a little anecdotal calibration curve based on how many chips of paint she ate versus what the doctor said was in her blood. Thankfully, we got that problem solved. But point being is paint chips are far more accessible. It's a lot harder to munch out of the side of a wall than it is for paint, which can easily flake. That would be my – and plus, even in the paint, it's a little bit more mobile in general than it would be if it's in concrete where it's encased in a new mineral structure.
But you know, concrete – falls apart. I mean, it chips off the sides of buildings. Your sidewalks develop cracks and chips and
you bet.
Little particles chip off. That's not dangerous if it's got coal ash in it?
No, because coal ash doesn't have that much to begin with. And so, you know, part of the issue is what level of trace elements are in these constituents? And then they're encapsulated. And then what fraction that can ultimately escape? So I think the most honest answer one can say is, can you find trace metals in ash concrete? Sure. Could you find it in traditional concrete? Sure. Is the incremental risk posed by the ash concrete more than the traditional concrete? Boy, I think that's that would be a difficult thing to discern.
So the three of you work with this material. You're either investigating it, analyzing it, putting it in new products. You're encouraging its, well, not encouraging necessarily, but you are guiding its use in industry. So, the EPA has said it is not hazardous. Should the EPA, should you guys, are you guys promoting it as something that ought to be used in more products?
As a recycled product, yes, it's essential. And let me draw some analogies here. If we don't put it into products, if we don't put into beneficial use structural fills, it's going in a landfill. And we saw this the last 3 years over the uncertainty of the regulations. There's all these landfills that are having to be built and built bigger. Okay, trees cut down. Because we're having to put coal ash in line landfills instead of being able to put it in a recycled application that was accepted for the last 20 years.
Are you getting pushback from people, significant pushback from people who say, no, 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 no?
We are getting it. The key thing is whether that pushback is based on good science, okay?
Yeah,
and that's where I go to UNC Charlotte.
Well, or anywhere. I mean, you know, the notion would be that you get data. That ought to drive what we do. So the extent to which it's a problem or not a problem, we can determine this sort of thing. So in the case of construction materials, that really requires no further investigation. In the case of ash ponds, in the case of ash structural fills, there you have to go on and test stuff. So, you know, Chris made reference earlier to there are regulations for structural fills. You don't just take a pile of ash and fill in a gully, fill in a low spot, and call it beneficial use. You actually do have to test it.
So was the airport's decision not to use coal ash a wise decision or an unwise decision?
So I'm very sympathetic to where they're at in the context of a lot of other issues, technical, political, financial. In terms of due diligence and in terms of an analysis of coal ash, I suppose the best thing we could say is it's premature to rule that out. Look, it may well be that ash from Riverbend, when subjected to the appropriate engineering analyses, both environmentally, geotechnically, stability, so on, is it conceivable that it's insufficient for precisely what they want? Sure. But you have to go through that process. You have to do the analysis. You have to look at the data. And so there's where I would suggest that it's premature. And there's where I would also suggest that getting back to this notion of a partnership, so I would promote the responsible use of ash, and it does help to have some leadership at the state level and at the federal level, much like the EPA has done as recent as 4 years ago.
As you've worked with this substance in developing the geopolymer cement, Brett, what have you discovered about this? Anything that you didn't know before? Any? Have you gotten any insights on other things that this could be, should be used for going forward?
In my research group, we primarily make a study of the mechanical characteristics of it. Of course, in parallel, we have groups that are studying some of the environmental characteristics of it. It's very important if we do intend to produce a truly sustainable material that we're looking at both of those. I would say that as the technology improves, we see just more opportunities to use it in a greater variety of infrastructure materials and discover more of the benefits in terms of durability as well as the environmental benefits associated with making it in a lower impact way.
It should be pointed out that Chris Harden, who is a professional geotechnical and environmental engineer and works with the substance and with companies who use this substance around the country, is also a farmer who's involved in sustainable farming. In Huntersville, I think, or
in Huntersville.
Okay, and you have a home that generates its own solar power. You have an 8-acre sustainable agriculture farm, which is powered by manual labor. These are your words, manual labor and solar, but also coal fire and nuclear power from Duke Energy. Why have you moved to generate as much solar energy, sustainable power as possible, given the fact that you are a proponent of using coal ash, the byproduct of generating coal electricity with coal?
We have some very interesting conversations on our farm because we're very much tied into the green movement, the organic farming movement. The reason why is I wanted to show my four kids and my wife that it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are about 60 to 70% carbon neutral, okay? And also, same way with recycling. We recycle about 70% of our waste. Okay. The reason we do that is we're trying to show folks that there is a sustainable way of life. Typically, it's in the middle, okay, between the two extremes.
Right.
It's working hard to get along, taking ideas from very sometimes opposite viewpoints and pulling them together. And we like to do that. Now, the other thing I always joke about is I'm one of the few guys who has calculated the coal ash that my family has generated over the last 20 years. Okay. People don't realize it. I mean, Duke Energy is responsible for that, but I generated that through Duke Energy.
Yes.
Okay?
They wouldn't be generating power if you didn't turn the lights on, run your computer, turn your TV, use your dishwasher, etc.
Or plug in my hybrid car.
Or turn the water on, because the water takes money to clean and pump, etc.
We all did. We all generated a portion of this ash. And that's the key thing. So we all have to work together on this. It really is a societal problem. So we have to really embrace different viewpoints and say, how can we do this the best?
Mm-hmm. Are you confident, Brett, as you develop uses for this and look into how it's being used, this coal ash, in building products, that there is not going to be a wake-up call 30, 40, 50 years down the road where somebody says, oh, boy, we should never have gone down that road?
I think we always need to keep doing our due diligence. I think that the question of which ashes are acceptable to use is a lot more nuanced. And so I think that we need to be investigating with our research and with a lot of public discussion about how to handle these materials exactly what the level of risk is that's associated with them. So I think that we are dealing with a new material in the geopolymer. I think that there's probably some research that could still be done even with regards to the material that we've been using for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's up to us to remain vigilant about doing research that fills in some of these gaps and continuing to ensure that it's safe.
We have all this coal ash sitting in ponds at 33 sites around the state that are associated with power generation. South Carolina began draining their ponds, drying the coal ash, and then scooping it out and using it for certain purposes. Are they ahead of the curve in South Carolina with regard to this, or are they just trying to make money?
Well, I'll first say that
both.
Closing a pond is one that requires extreme engineering care. But let me pass it on to Chris. I think he's got something to say about that.
First of all, digging out wet coal ash ponds is not easy. I'm one of the specialists in the monitoring of these ponds with pore water pressure. It has to be done carefully. One of the concerns I have about
Why does it have to be done carefully?
If you put heavy equipment out on that and you don't have the water taken out properly, you get a release of what's called the pore water. You get excess pore water pressure, and you can lose the heavy equipment and the operator who's doing that in the wet coal ash.
So it's like quicksand.
It can be.
Uh-huh.
The way you do that, you drain it carefully and slowly. That's why the power companies, the engineers work on this, need to have a systematic way to work on a solution over the next 3 to 5 years. It's partly safety of the workers. I'm looking at some of the biggest coal ash ponds in the country right now. You have to be careful on this. That's one item. Digging it all out may also not be the best thing for the environment. We encourage something called the net environmental benefit analysis. Because digging it out, just imagine if you take it out of one of the sites near Charlotte, it could easily be, we calculated out, 70,000 trucks rolling down the road.
Okay. Yes. North Carolina Department of Environmental and Natural Resources Secretary John Scavaria says to empty just one of these large coal ash ponds would take one truck every 3 minutes, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week for 30 years.
So maybe,
oh, my God.
Maybe before you do that, you make sure you know what the benefit's going to be.
Yeah. And then also you've got dust emissions off of that. We have to look at the whole environmental benefit analysis to see if that's best. I think some of these we do need to dig away from the rivers. Okay,
no.
I think it's prudent. Okay, but it has to be a systematic design approach.
But isn't there an issue with the coal ash that has been sitting wet in these ponds for such a long time in terms of its reuse? There's a difference in coal ash that you scoop dry out of the generator and coal ash that's been sitting for 40 years in a pond, right?
Correct, Brett.
Brett?
That's right.
Again, it really depends on the ashes. So we've discovered that there's some ashes that are fairly little changed, and even mechanical treatment like grinding might restore their reactivity, and there's other ashes that are probably not suitable at all for use in construction materials after that.
Because after 40 years in the water, something happens to it? It's more like clay or something? Is that right?
It can get a crust of a clay-like material on the surface of it, which reduces the reactivity. We can grind that up and use that. But I think we really need to look at these stores of ash store by store, fill by fill, and see which ones are the most feasible to use for construction.
And what do you do
materials.
With stuff that is not feasible to use for construction materials?
I would use it in an encapsulated structural fill. You could be putting it with cement, okay, beneath a highway. It would not necessarily be for concrete, a high-quality surface pavement product, but it would be fine for flowable fill or using in deep fills beneath highways or runways. That's the type of place it's been used for years.
So it would be helpful to have, for example, the North Carolina Department of Transportation to go on and promote its use at their own facilities. And this would be an opportunity for a partnership. You can imagine the ideal scenario of a good partnership between the North Carolina Department of the Environment and Natural Resources, the Department of Transportation, other agencies, other municipalities, and have this choreographed with engineers. Make sure that things are done so that you are getting the data. You do it where it makes sense. If you do have a problem with metals, you don't use it or you treat it or contain it. But have that as part of a process where at the top of the food chain is reused.
How would you characterize the number of willing recipients to take this coal ash and use it in products that they are making? Are there enough? Are there too many? Are there not enough people who are willing to do it?
There were more 3 to 5 years ago, but as the stigma came out, we've seen a decrease.
And how do you dispel the stigma?
I think a lot of it's by education.
Data.
And a lot of it also, I have to say, the engineering community has a real responsibility, and also they have a role in this to bring solutions to the table.
Chris Harden is a professional geotechnical and environmental engineer who works with coal ash and with people using coal ash around the country. Brett Tempest is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at UNC Charlotte and part of the team that built that wonderful solar decathlon house, greenhouse, which uses coal ash, by the way. And John Daniels, an associate professor and interim chair of the civil and environmental engineering department at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.